ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey there, Sana Qadar from All in the Mind here. If you're a true crime fan, you should check out our new series, Forensic. It's all about the psychological tools and tricks that are used to investigate crime. Want to hear more? Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
So in just the last hour, the Utah mom who published a book on grief after her husband's death has been sentenced to life in prison with no parole for his murder.
It's a poisoning case that has transfixed the United States almost to the extent that the trial of mushroom murderer Erin Patterson did here in Australia last year.
Prosecutors said that Richin slipped five times the lethal dose of fentanyl into a cocktail that she made for her husband. They said Richin's killed her husband for money while planning to start a new life with the new man.
Hi, Damien Carrick with you. This is The Law Report on ABC Radio National. In Salt Lake City, Utah, 35-year-old real estate agent Kuri Richins, a mother of three, will spend the rest of her life behind bars for the murder of her husband Eric and a raft of other related offences. In handing down the sentence, Judge Richard Mrazek said,
"A person convicted of those things is simply too dangerous to ever be free."
Professor Tennille Brown is an expert in evidence law at the University of Utah and has followed the case closely. Tennille, how much attention has this case received in the US?
Well, I would say it's received massive attention. And when I was watching the live stream of the sentencing hearing, I was on just one tiny outlet called the East Idaho News, and there were 15,000, 20,000 people watching the sentencing just on that one outlet at that time. It's all over the local news. It's all over the national news.
And why do you think this murder trial and this sentencing has gathered so much attention?
Yeah, I think there's a lot going on in this case that really drew us in. This one is not ordinary. It's a woman who's the perpetrator, which is highly unusual, and then it's poison, which is less than 1% of all homicides. But it's also in a fairly wealthy suburb of Salt Lake. It's up in the mountains. It's an attractive woman. She's fairly young. She's presenting herself on social media as being this perfect mom. So there are all these things to pull our attention in, and it's surprising. And I also think people really wanted accountability. So I think there's another overarching story here about, I don't know what's happening for you all in Australia, but right now things are kind of falling apart legally in the United States. And there's just very little accountability for big picture wrongdoing. So we kind of still have this thirst for accountability. And it's very much at this micro level of individuals. But I think there's still something very satisfying for people to see someone doing something wrong and to be punished severely. I also think that there are a lot of other things going on with this being a case from Utah where we have just so much sexism. And your listeners may not know that Utah usually ranks kind of dead last when it comes to gender equality. So there's a lot of perfectionism. There's a lot of performative mothering in Utah. There's a lot of the need to worry more about what people think of you than what actually is true. So I think there's a lot of that going on here as well.
We might come back to that later. There's also something about poisoning, something about offering food and drink and sharing conversation with someone as you watch them die. There's something particularly extraordinary about that kind of crime. It's not the normal physical violence which accompanies a homicide.
Absolutely. It's much more sinister. It's much more deliberate. In a cynical way, I think many of us don't want to live in a world where we can't trust the kind of kindness and the gift of food that is given to us because it's such an ordinary thing. It's not like a gunshot wound after a fight or, you know, something where someone is responding with emotion and feeling very triggered. This is something very deceptive and very planned. And the fact that someone so close to you has access to your kitchen table and could easily poison you, I think makes it much scarier and much more freaky.
So there was a jarring, stark mismatch between Kuri's crimes as found by the jury and the image she projected out into the world. A pretty stark example of that is the children's book she published after the death of her husband. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so she went on a local TV show, a very popular TV show called Good Things Utah, and she promoted this book that she apparently did not write. She had a ghostwriter write. But she was talking about how her children, when they were grieving and those late hours at night when things were the most depressing, she really wanted some kind of book to read to them to help them process their grief. And she couldn't find it. And so she wrote it. And she had reached out to the TV station to try to get on air to promote this book. And so I think when people heard about that, and certainly the jurors, two of the jurors who spoke after the trial said, hearing that she had written that book really shocked them as well. It made them think, it fit into this narrative of her trying to profit off of the death and not spending a lot of time grieving, going straight into kind of entrepreneurial mode. It really rubbed people the wrong way. And if things were different and she hadn't been convicted of his murder, we might read those facts differently. And we might think that that was a very loving gift to her children. But now with the guilty convictions, I think it just puts that in a very different light.
The book was titled Are You With Me? And it's a self-published children's book. And it's about a father with angel wings watching over his young son after he's passed away. And I've seen the cover of the book, and the similarity of the man with wings to Eric Richens is pretty strong. So it's directly about her experience and that of her children.
Absolutely. And she's definitely presenting this as if it is this beautiful tragedy. But at the same time, the story that she was telling, or that her defense counsel were telling during the trial, was that Eric was a drug addict. He was a pill popper, that he had accidentally overdosed. And that's a little jarring. So for people who've experienced overdose, they're usually not out there writing a kid's book about the overdose. And so I think there were some question marks already in people's minds around her and in her in-laws, the family's minds, about how could she write a book about something that was just such a tragedy, that it wasn't like it was, you know, late stage cancer or something like that.
So she said he died of a drug overdose. How did the jury find that Eric died?
So the forensic toxicologist report showed that he had 5 times the lethal dose of fentanyl in his system. And the story that the prosecution told was that Corey had made him a drink, a cocktail, to celebrate her closing on a house. It was a big project that she was working on. And she claims that he had ingested the fentanyl, but the jury found that she had given him the fentanyl in this cocktail.
So 5 times the fatal dose of fentanyl was found in his system. Corey was found guilty of other charges, including an attempted murder by poisoning. What do we know about that incident?
Yeah, so I think this was highly relevant to the judge in sentencing. But 17 days before Eric died of the ultimate fentanyl overdose, he also had gotten very sick. And the jury found that she had attempted to murder him on that occasion with a sandwich that also had opioids laced inside it. So she had, according to the prosecution, reached out to her housekeeper and asked for opioids. She'd asked for fentanyl. She put it in a sandwich, according to the prosecution, that the jury then believed. And he ate the sandwich, got very sick, immediately started thinking that maybe Corey had poisoned him, told his family that if anything happened to him, it was Corey. And then instead of maybe feeling remorseful at, oh my God, I can't believe what I did, I tried to poison my husband, 17 days later, she tries again. And this time she asks for a higher dose of fentanyl from her housekeeper and said, you know, it didn't work last time, we need a higher dose. And so I think just that lack of remorse for thinking about that, attempting to do that, and then when it didn't work, instead of backing off, she just forged ahead and said, no, I'm so committed to murdering him that not even 3 weeks have gone by and I'm going to try again.
So she bought the fentanyl from the family house cleaner, Carmen Lauber, and Carmen Lauber's evidence was that she sold fentanyl to Corey 4 times, but never to Eric. And Corey said after the poisoned sandwich from his favourite diner, I think this was on Valentine's Day 2022. Shortly after that, Corey asked Carmen for, quote, some of the Michael Jackson stuff. Michael Jackson, of course, died as a result of a drug overdose. So she was asking for stronger fentanyl from a supplier.
That's right. And Carmen testified to that. And Carmen's history was like a lot of people's history. It was a little bit checkered. She'd been in and out of jail for various drug offenses, and she had agreed to testify. And then the prosecution said they wouldn't be prosecuting her for her involvement in this if she provided testimony. And that's really common to have someone as an informant who gets sort of a deal. But that was something that the defense really tried to play up, that you can't trust the credibility of Carmen because she's just trying to, you know, get off or lessen her sentence. And she doesn't have credibility because she has this history of drug offenses. But the jury bought it. The jury found her nonetheless credible. And her testimony was corroborated by some of the GPS location data from the cell phones that showed that Corey was meeting up with Carmen at a gas station right before the two times she had attempted to poison and then poisoned Eric.
And they accepted, or would appear to have accepted, that Carmen Lauber was not in on the plan. She was simply supplying drugs for her employer and perhaps her employer's family consumption.
That's right. And to the extent there was any more prosecution evidence that she knew about the plans, she got some kind of immunity where she wouldn't be prosecuted for that. But that was not something, the jury found her to just be someone who was a supplier and not someone who was in on the plan.
Tennille, aside from the evidence of Carmen Lauber, what was the evidence of the prosecution? What did it discover on the search history of Corey Richin's telephone?
So she was looking for what dose was required to kill someone with fentanyl. She was looking into things like, what could the FBI determine based on drug toxicology results, and could they pinpoint the source of fentanyl? She'd also searched for things like high-end prisons, and she was looking to see if there were certain facilities that might have better programming and better facilities. She had a search history that was very strong circumstantial evidence of trying to either cover up the crime or trying to see what could the prosecution prove.
The court heard that Corey had also taken out a number of life insurance policies on her husband without telling him. How substantial were those policies?
Yeah, they were million-dollar policies, and she had taken those out shortly before this whole plan seems to have been orchestrated. There was a prenup that was signed, so her husband, Eric, had a big ranching family, lots of property. They had a construction business that was quite lucrative, and she had been written out of all of that, so she was no longer going to be the beneficiary of his estate. And so she had also, I think, mortgaged the house without telling him, and that had led to a big row. But the life insurance policy, the timing of it was right before she had orchestrated this plan. And there was one for $1.5 million, I believe, and another one for about $1 million as well.
So Corey worked as a house flipper and I think as a real estate agent. Was she in a good financial place?
She was not. In fact, she had made a number of really bad deals that had gone south. She had invested in properties. The idea was to flip them, but they were not selling for what she had hoped for. She had taken out some very large debts. She had even, some of her close friends came forward and said that she had deceived them, where she had said that she was getting a mortgage for them and ended up actually just using their assets to siphon money back to herself. So there were a number of insurance fraud claims, and the two that she was prosecuted for here, she was found guilty of. And that was really important because that financial gain that she sought and that being the reason for murdering Eric actually elevated this from just homicide to aggravated homicide, which meant that she could get life without parole.
Life without parole. Look, another part of the prosecution case was that Corey was actually in a romantic relationship with another man, not her husband.
That was another piece of the prosecution puzzle here is, you know, you don't have to prove motive. The prosecution normally doesn't have to prove motive. In this case, motive of financial gain does make it an aggravated murder, but normally you don't have to say why someone killed someone else, right? Like that's even the interesting piece in the Aaron Patterson case. Is still a bit of a question mark. But jurors and the public, like the why really matters to them. And so when you pull together all these puzzle pieces of she was having an affair, she was in an extraordinary amount of debt, she had, without Eric's knowledge, taken on two new life insurance policies in his name right before he died, then you start to, that circumstantial evidence starts to really weave together to show someone killing someone intentionally for financial gain and to start over. The idea was According to her paramour, who she was having an affair with, this house that she had purchased, they were going to rent it out for events. And she had this whole future planned with him that didn't involve Eric. And so he needed to get out of the picture so she could kind of reset and start over with, more money in the bank and a new partner.
Now, perhaps one of the most crucial pillars of the prosecution case was something called the walk the dog letter. Tell me about that letter.
Yeah, that letter was very interesting because it was something that she wrote to her mother while she was in jail.
She was on remand, sitting in jail awaiting the trial, yeah.
Yes, that's right. So they did what kind of a toss-up of her cell, found this letter. Initially, she claimed that it was attorney-client privilege, but there was nothing indicating that it was communication with her attorney or about legal advice. It was clearly written to her mother, and she was asking her mother to create a story of Eric having a drug problem and going to Mexico to get drugs. And the walk the dog was what she was reminding her mom to do at the top of that. We heard in the sentencing that that walk the dog letter also included Corey's making threats to Katie's family and her daughters. Katie is Eric's sister and Corey's former sister-in-law. So this letter seemed to be tampering with witnesses. And in fact, that came up as an issue. It's part of, I think, why Sky Lazaro had to step that down as maybe some kind of conflict. Part of the story there too was, I guess, her firm was representing Katie's family and some of the estate business. But the letter really was terrible. It was damning. It was Corey telling her mom to plant evidence and to get her brother to testify to a story that made it look like Eric was the one who took the fentanyl because he would frequently go to Mexico and get fentanyl from drug cartels because of the pain that he was experiencing.
And the jury heard an excerpt of that letter in court. Here's where it talks about some of the evidence Corey Richens wanted her brother Ronnie to give about her husband's trips to Mexico. It's being read out by a police detective during the trial.
Eric told Ronnie he gets pain pills and fentanyl from Mexico from the workers at the ranch. Not to tell me because I would get mad because I always said he just gets high every night and won't help take care of the kids.
I mean, was there any evidence that Eric Richens had a history of drug use, either as legitimate pain release or as a recreational drug user? I mean, was there anything in his medical history?
No, there was nothing in his medical history. The only inference we get of his drug use from Corey, there was nothing from his family said that that was completely made up. There was no evidence in any of his medical history. There was no prescription evidence. There was no pharmaceutical evidence. There were no pill packs where she could show that he had had OxyContin or something prescribed to him. So there was no evidence of that. I think part of the reason that we didn't see Corey testify or anyone testify in her defense was that if she had raised that, if she had said that Eric was using drugs, then she would have opened the door to a lot of contradictory evidence coming in. And so if she wanted to kind of thread that needle with her defense of placing seeds of doubt as if Eric might be the one who was getting the pain meds. But if she had actually presented admissible evidence about that, then she would have been trounced on, I think, with the cross-examination. And so that's probably part of why there was no defense and there were no witnesses that were testifying for the defense, because if she had made that based on admissible evidence, I think she would have been crushed. They would have just come at her so hard with, like, where's the evidence of that? Where are you getting this from? And I think she would have been, her witnesses would not have stood up to that kind of cross-examination.
You're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National. And today we're talking about the extraordinary case of Corey Richens, who's just been sentenced to life without parole for the murder of her husband, Eric Richens, USA. My guest is University of Utah evidence expert, Professor Tennille Brown. Tennille, what was the defense case? Corey Richens didn't give any evidence at the trial. You say they were trying to thread a needle with casting shade on Eric Richens. What was their case?
Yeah, so they didn't present any evidence, but in their cross-examination of the state's evidence, they were insinuating that Eric had a pain problem and that he took fentanyl and that he would have ingested the fentanyl himself to cope with the pain. They didn't introduce any evidence of that, but their defense was that this was an accidental overdose, a tragic accidental overdose. And they kept pointing to the fact that the state could not prove that Corey put the fentanyl in Eric's drink.
So the defense painted the deceased as a drug user when he wasn't. How significant was that strategy, trying to paint the victim as responsible for their own death? It's a high-risk strategy, isn't it?
It's absolutely high risk, and I think it backfired in this case. You saw in the victim impact statements at the sentencing where Katie, Eric's sister, was really fired up about that story being that Eric had used drugs. And she was, you could tell, visibly pretty furious that Corey was trying to paint the victim as the one who caused this. And
well, extraordinary. At the trial earlier this year, it only took the jury 3 hours after quite a long trial to come back with the guilty verdict. So it was quite extraordinary, really, how quickly the jury turned that around. Now, we've just had the sentencing hearing and the judge deliver his sentence. You mentioned the submissions made by some of Eric Richens' family, victim impact statements made to the judge. There were also, and I guess we can describe them as victim impact statements, read out to the court by a therapist on behalf of the three children. What did they say?
Yeah, they also had some shocking allegations. So each of the three children shared their comments, and each of them said that they wanted Corey to get life without parole. They were definitely not painting a story of Corey as the doting mother who had written a book to help them grieve. They were painting a story of a woman who was drunk all of the time. And actually, I think two of the children mentioned that she was always drunk and that she would lock them in their room with a lock on the outside so that she could party and that she could do things without them being around. So it was a stark contrast to the testimony that her side brought about what a loving mother she was, about how she had encouraged them to work at food banks and had donated a bunch of snowshoes to people in need. They were presenting a story of a mom who was very neglectful in the wake of their father's death.
And here's an excerpt of the therapist reading a statement from one of Corey Richens' three sons.
I want the judge to know my dad was a good person and I miss my dad. I miss my dad, but I do not miss how my life used to be. I don't miss Corey. I will tell you that.
And I think these kids are now, these boys are now 13, 12 and 10. So they're still very, very young.
Still very young. It's just, it's horrible. I mean, they did not want her to be released. They did not want to ever see her again. And apparently she has written them cards and she has called them and the number has been blocked according to her. So she's trying to reach out to them and that has just been blocked. So she used her sentencing statement, which was very long.
45 minutes, I believe, in which she addressed her three sons directly.
Be like your dad. Be generous. Be charitable. Stay humble.
Yeah, and I have a lot of thoughts on that because I listened to the whole thing and it sounded like the most uninspired graduation speech, just tons of platitudes. And she said things like, live loud, laugh often. I've loved you before I met you. And then she said the most baffling things about how you should always take accountability when you're wrong and you should apologize when you're wrong. And that just landed like a ton of bricks because here she is convicted of murdering their dad, never once apologized, never once really showed any sign of remorse. And she's now saying you need to take responsibility when you've made a mistake. There were so many platitudes in this speech. It just sounded like a bunch of Instagram memes. And it sounded so hollow and so tone deaf, given that she had been convicted of murder and she's still maintaining her innocence and she's appealing. They already made their statement, the defense, that they plan to appeal. So she didn't sound very remorseful. She didn't seem very sad. But then when she started talking about her boys, she was tearing up and she was whimpering. But I think it was just like maybe too little emotion, too late.
So it was a one-day sentencing hearing. And at the end of the day, the judge handed down the life without parole sentence for the murder, the attempted murder, the insurance fraud, or all the other offences. How did Corey Richens respond when the sentence was delivered?
So she looked down, her lip was quivering, and he made again this instruction to say, out of respect for everyone in the courtroom, please do not show any outward signs of emotion. If you're feeling very emotional, please look down. But I noticed that Katie, Eric's sister, when he read the sentence of life without parole, Katie looked very relieved. And she kind of went like, oh, thank God, which I guess, you know, she wasn't supposed to do. But I think that would be very hard in that moment to not express some kind of emotion.
And his sister, Katie Richens-Benson, was among family members who gave impact statements to the judge. Here's some of what she said about the loss of her brother.
He was taken away from us by a person he should have been able to trust, the person he should have trusted most in the world, his wife.
Tennille, can we zoom out? What is the wider cultural context of this trial? You talked a little bit about it at the beginning of our conversation. You say that Utah is a very conservative society. How does that impact, do you think, on this case and the way it was received?
Yeah, so it's a very sexist state. And Corey was a very young bride and a young mom, which is also very common here. It's a much younger age for most people to become mothers, but it is often cited as the most misogynist in all of the US because women hold beliefs that women should not work, they should stay in the home and raise the kids. There's also a lot of competition over performing your motherhood here. And most of my friends will joke about this because you go to a school event, like we have Valentine's Day here or Halloween, and the parents, the moms are so competitive about the costumes and about the Valentine's Day boxes. They put all of their energy into these crafts for the kids. And it is really a performative culture around parenting. It's also a culture where we have really, really high rates of plastic surgery for women. And so there's just a lot of these outward indicators of women here feeling this need to be perfect and to perform their motherhood in a very overt way. That's where the value comes from. There's a ton of benevolent sexism where women are really wonderful, but they're weak. And so you don't see a lot of women in corporate positions in Utah. We have some of the lowest rates of women as executives in any state. We have huge pay gaps between women and men. And we also just have the lowest female labor force participation among mothers in the entire US. So Corey, kind of her success and her educating herself and her becoming a real estate agent, she's already sort of flipped the script. And she's walking that tightrope that a lot of moms have to walk, where they have to be a perfect mother. And then they also want to be crushing it in their work. And that's not to make light of what she did or to make any excuses. But I really think that there was a lot of the culture of sexism going on here, where here, what matters is not the kind of person you are. It's like the kind of person you are when people are watching, the posting that you've curated, your perfect life on social media, what people think of you as opposed to how you actually are. And that's, I know that's true in a lot of places in the United States, but it's especially true in Utah. And I do think that this like idea that a broken family or that divorce is the worst possible thing also played a role here, because Katie and Amy, Eric's sisters, both mentioned in their statements during the sentencing hearing that they begged Eric to leave, that they knew things were really bad, that Corey, when she had defrauded him by putting another mortgage on their house without telling him, they said, you need to leave. And then after the attempted poisoning, where he said, I think that Corey's behind this, again, the sisters were saying, you need to leave. And they were family members. Clint, I believe his brother-in-law, was trying to find him a divorce attorney and helped him connect with the divorce attorney. And ultimately, they said he was just so afraid of hurting the kids and so afraid of breaking up the family that he did not pursue a divorce. And to me, that's the very sad statement here, is like, why is divorce just so bad that it would be better to stay with a woman who's trying to kill you? Like, is that better for your kids? We've got this very mixed message in our culture that divorce is the worst possible thing you could do, but you're missing the idea that like what may be worse for the kids is them growing up in a home with parents who clearly hate each other and that are actually trying to kill each other.
Professor Tennille Brown, an expert in evidence law based at the University of Utah, thank you very much for speaking to The Law Report.
You're very welcome.
That's all we have time for this week. Do follow The Law Report on ABC Listen. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. And a big thanks to producer Christina Kukolia and also to audio producer Elise Simons. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.